Welcome to the Solar Storm. This is your host, Kyle Hunt, coming to you on RenegadeBroadcasting.com. Today is September 24th, 2017. I encourage you to please check out RenegadeTribune.com and all of the great sister sites, including the new HeathenHerbs.com. Tonight, I have a very courageous man who has been seeking the truth and pointing others in the right direction for quite some time now. And he has paid dearly for being involved with this struggle, for being a leader in this struggle, and yet he continues on. Dr. Frederick Tobin is a very interesting man with a very interesting past, which we'll learn about here tonight. You might have heard of his Adelaide Institute in Australia and his multiple imprisonments for telling the truth as he sees it. Dr. Frederick Tobin, welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Or should I say good afternoon or evening to you? What's your time, Mr. Hunt?
It is 8.02 p.m. here.
Eastern Indeed, time. And we already are on Monday the 25th, and it's just after 9.30 in the morning. So there's a little bit of a time difference. And I always jest when I speak with American friends that you may be ahead in many things, but you'll never catch up to our time. How's that?
That sounds accurate. Well, for an intro tonight, I was looking for a label for you. Holocaust revisionist. That is a label that is often applied to you, but one that you don't use yourself. To describe yourself, your enemies, your detractors, will often call you a Holocaust denier. If you had to label yourself with a few words, how would you do so?
I would certainly not label myself a denier, nor an anti-Semite, nor a racist, nor what are the other ones? A Holocaust, an anti-racist,
xenophobe.
All these labels for me are in some respects a problem, because they restrict what I've been doing all my life, and that is essentially trying to understand what's going on. And if you give yourself a label, for example, the common theoretical structure that most people fall into is class thinking, that you, for example, belong to the middle class, the lower class, the upper class, and so on. I was in at the end of my high school year when my sister got married to a lecturer at a university, and he considered himself to be a member of the upper middle class. Now, I thought that was funny. I was aware of lower class, middle class, upper class, but upper middle class. And so I said, well, because I'm a peasant farmer's son, a landed gentry, but of peasant size, I said to him, look, if you belong to the upper middle class, I'm of the lower upper class. And he got so annoyed, because he also thought that he belonged to the High Church of England, not the Low Church of England. And so I said, I'm a member of the lower upper class. And he said, no, you're not. You're just a bloody immigrant. And so my awareness of being labeled came to the fore. I was 10 when I came to Australia. We couldn't speak any English. We were called German bastards and Nazis and all sorts of things.
And so people know
you at that time. I didn't know even what a Nazi was.
Right. You were born. You were born in Germany. For some of the listeners out there that might not be familiar with your story, which you've told elsewhere on a number of different occasions and in your books as well. So people can definitely check that out, Tobin.biz. But you were born 1944 in Germany as the war was gruesomely winding to a close. But you obviously have no recollection of that particular time. But is there anything else you can mention about your time living in Germany until you were 10 when you moved?
Not really, except we're living on a farm, a small farm. And we were in touch with nature. This is what I always enjoyed when the seasonal changes occurred, the autumn harvests occurred. You could smell nature. This later on in one tended to drift away from, but always. When I came in contact with certain theoretical structures like this class thinking, I couldn't align that to the natural order, this idea of being at one with nature. If I just jump ahead now and talk about global warming and so on, then all I know is that our human activity is massive on the planet, but we cannot tame the natural forces. We can utilize them, but we cannot tame them. We have to submit to them. Just as the Indonesians in Bali are doing at the moment, they're preparing themselves for the volcano to erupt there and do its bit. So automatically, with this farming background, I had a problem when I went to university and was confronted with theoretical structures. I had great disagreements with lecturers, and consequently, I wasn't too successful in my first year. but I didn't realize that up to a point, you had to, in order to pass, unless you were extremely brilliant, you could dialectically challenge the theoretical structures that came towards you. For example, as a teacher, I must mention this. It's an interesting little story. As an English teacher, in the 80s, I saw the movement of that disintegration of solid educational thrustings flourishing, where individuals were trimmed and developed into individuals who could be called to be authentic and who listened to their inner voice, to their innate senses. But that didn't happen. And I remember I had one student who just walked around in the class, and I said, "Oh, please sit down." And he said, "Oh, make me." So I walked up to him and I said, "Would you please sit down?" He said, "Make me, you fucking poofed a pommy bastard." And so I just grabbed him by the head or by the hair and pushed him into the seat. Now, that was an incident, but he didn't know that I had a German background. Once students realized I had a German background, then, of course, I was the Nazi and Hitler and so on. What I'm saying is I could have played the victim. I could have said, "Oh, look, you know, they're victimizing me with this, my Nazi past or my parents' Nazi past and so on." When in fact, this is what life is all about. And when I hear people talking about how they've been victimized by all sorts of things. Even now, at the moment, we have the yes-no vote concerning gay marriage or marriage equality, and I just say, basically, grow up, people, grow up. This is life. This is this kind of battling is life. And if you want to play the victim, you know, go away, and don't work on yourself. Just play the victim and continue sobbing. And I mean, it's a whole industry. It's a whole industry. Oh, yeah. But I'm diverting from your basic question.
It's interesting. Even back then, basically, children weren't able to be disciplined at all. And yes, you're not that child's parent. And at a certain point, we are really suffering from a lack of discipline, from a lack of respect and honor. And if you try to instill those values in children now, you are considered a Nazi, regardless of your past, your parents' past, or whether or not you're a German at all.
Yes, indeed. This is where any positive value, such as discipline, personal discipline, can be observed in the animal world or even in the birds. We've got magpies here strutting about. And I was driving along a road once, and I stopped because in the gutter there were three or four birds fighting magpies. And I thought, you know, what's going on? So I stopped, and I saw that two bigger magpies were hopping into a littler one who was then sort of lying on the back and getting pummeled about. Now, what was that? That was mother and father disciplining their little kid. This happens again and again. For example, I'd throw out a piece of cheese to a magpie, and a little one came along, strutting along, and it was about to grab it, and then suddenly he flipped over onto his back with legs in the air. And I thought, what's going on? And then along struts father, big fellow, comes along and he gobbles it up. In other words, there is a sort of a pecking order. There is a natural order of things. If you imbue the young with nothing, no values whatsoever, or this concept of equality, this idiotic concept of equality. On the one hand, you have equality. On the other hand, you have choices. I was frustrated by what kind of ideology came into the education system. On the one hand, you said to students, you know, we're all equal. On the other hand, oh, look, you know, you've got to make choices. It's your choice. Well, that neutralizes the mind when you have equality. We're all equal, okay. And then you have choices. So what happens? Your mind is switched off, and then anything below, well, below is okay. And this leads to a sensual kind of awakening that leads to hedonism, that leads to a kind of yearning for the baser things of life, and that ultimately leads to self-destruction. You know, it's the consumer society, that argument, where we can do what we want to do to self-destruct. We have the freedom to go shopping, but not the freedom to criticize and upset people. And in my case, it's been going for nearly 25 years. Adding my education battle, it'd be 30 whatever years. Mm-hmm. That you cannot upset people. I was charged with this, that I was upsetting the students. Can you imagine? I was upsetting the students because I demanded that every day they. Well, when they leave school, at night, they have to learn, for example, 10 spelling words a day. And we test them the next day, every day, 5 days a week. And no, that was too demanding because spelling didn't really matter. It was all right to get things wrong. And you know, there's American spelling, there's English spelling, there's Australian spelling. So take it easy. The standards don't matter as long as you can express yourself. Right. So that's the kind of thing that you certainly, I think, know about. And I'm, look, I must say, I admire your website with the spread of articles that, that you're running. I can't kind of find a fault that that there are issues that you don't shy away from. And I think this was also as an educator, one of my principles, that you must know about everything, but you need not have done everything.
Right. And I really, I knew when I was in school that something was seriously wrong, because so much money, teacher time, attention, resources in general was given to the different classrooms for special needs, special education it was called. But these children weren't actually special. They were just the troublemakers. And we had this program instituted by the Bush government of No Child Left Behind. And essentially what I take that to mean is no child gets ahead. Basically, that's the only way that that can happen. If you don't, we're being forced to drag ourselves down for the benefit of the weakest link in the classroom, let's say. And it's just very interesting that they do preach equality, yet they have a grading system. Does A plus equal C minus? No, of course it does not. Our very reality is based upon discrimination and inequality. Everything is not equal. Even this apple over here is not equal to that apple. It has a different color. It weighs a different amount. It's very frustrating for my mind and other minds, even if they don't know exactly why, to be fed contradictions on a daily basis. Children should ideally be learning and actually enjoying quite a bit of it, eager to know more. But that's not the case. And a lot of that doesn't, a lot of the fault there isn't necessarily just because they are ill-disciplined, but because they are not being taught the inspiring or important information.
Indeed, indeed. The element is really this cliche thought, this idea that it's bread and circus to the full. But there's this one element that always crops up again. Certainly in Australia, you have private schools, and if you have the money, you can get to a private school and get a decent education. Now, that to me is not on. For example, I flew once from Adelaide to Sydney or Brisbane, and I got on the Qantas plane and I said to the flight attendant, look, I've got a complaint. I'm being discriminated against. And you could tell she felt rather tense that here there was possibly trouble. I said, look, I've got this economy seat, but I would like to sit in business because I'm being discriminated against. I want to sit in business. And she just laughed and said, oh, well, you can buy that. I said, I haven't got the money. And therefore, I said, you're discriminating on the grounds of my not having this money. And so I think that would be a case. And she just laughed and we left it at that. But that's where we're getting at. If you have the financial clout, then you can buy or get that certain educational lift. And what you've then got is those who've got the money. It reminds me of a story in Australia about a convict. He used to say, some people have plenty money and no brains, and some have plenty brains and no money. Surely men with plenty brains and no money was made for men with plenty money and no brains.
Yes. And people with money can afford to discriminate. They have discriminating tastes, and they really only want the best for their family and for and for their security as well, which is why they're able to live in gated communities. And so they can afford to be discriminating, whereas the people out there who cannot afford to be discriminating are forced to live amongst this equality that we have all around us. And it is a sick, deranged society that has resulted from everything supposedly being equal. And in fact, that's a lie as well, in that there are a lot of things that are better than white people, better than normal, historical, traditional culture, such as the LGBTQZ rainbow. That is to be held up above our traditional society. And this is, it's just very, very frustrating to see where we've come since, well, the 1940s, since you've been alive. That this slippery slope has turned into quite a mudslide, and it's because people were not willing to check it in its track. It was basically incentivized to go along to get along, and people need to support their families, so they don't want to rock the boat. Very few people have stood up and tried to stop this crazy train in its tracks, and you're one of those people. You told us about what happened a bit with your position in the school. Could you elaborate a little bit more on what you went through there and how you fought that and how this ordeal led to some troubles in your life? It seems you lost your wife out of this, your first wife, and then also how this could have led to your seeking truth about the World War II era, trying to bring back honor to your ancestors as well.
Indeed, the situation. Sometimes I flippantly now say, look, had I not had these troubles, I was 40 when I lost my teaching job, got thrown out. It took me nearly 10 years to have this dismissal declared invalid, but I wasn't put back in. The State Education Department in Victoria wouldn't employ me. I had to go to South Australia to get re-employment. Luckily, the fellow who was behind all this, Ken Boston, he had become at my time in the 80s, he was a regional director of education. Then he became the director general in South Australia, and he had the same problem. He kicked out a long-standing principal, dismissed him. A judge re invested, I was going to say, a judge re put him back in, negated that decision. Boston went to New South Wales, became the head of education there. He then dismissed the longest serving principal at Lismore High School, Norm Robinson. And that was in 93. And I got to know all these people with whom this Boston fellow had problems. And in South Australia, when I got my registration there as a committee of about 16 on the teacher registration board, I had Max Smith with me. And I said, oh, look, blah, blah, blah. The fellow behind this is Ken Boston. And I said, blah, blah, blah. And the chair, she said, look, we are well aware of his administrative legacy. You do not have to talk about that, blah, blah, blah. And went on and on. And I got my registration. Now, in New South Wales, the same thing. Norm Robinson, he criticized the education department's head. And at the end of December 92, at a speech night, and then in January, he went back to his school, tried to open the door, but the locks had been changed. And so I made contact with him, Norm Robinson. He was put back in. But the fellow who was responsible, South Victoria, State of Victoria, South Australia, New South Wales, he then went to London and he became head of the examining board. And then after 10 years, he resigned because he made a mess of things there as well. But the problem was, in South Australia, he was known as the barbecue set. Of the feminist, he embraced the feminist and the left wing, and he trundled on with that kind of mindset, when in fact he was living it up financially. He was well off and he loved his yachts and whatever, but ideologically he didn't resist. He just went with the flow, and you can see that kind of element coming through. Even in among the so-called revisionists, those who want to go along with something, or those who are hardcore and so on. And then what I've noticed is we have to look at some very basic issues, such as this concept that as individuals we have moral, social and legal duties. You cannot simply say, oh, look, our societies run through the courts. Ideologies are set in concrete. For example, we have this historical element, the Nuremberg war crimes trials, the International Military Tribunal decisions. They're set in legal concrete. In order to undo that, and on this, the post-World War II order rests, in order to undo that is a great problem. Likewise with 9/11 now. In legal concrete is set the Silberstein payout and other things that impacted on that event, because if now the truth emerges, then we've got problems. We actually then expose what's going on. We can then go back to the Kennedy assassination and so on, Pearl Harbor and whatever. It goes on and on, and you can see that the legal element is extremely important as a mechanism to silence individuals. And I've had that, as I said, since I had that experience with the education department in the courts. I was lucky there, but it cost. It's a tremendous stress on the family, and you mentioned that before. That is the greatest problem. Then once the family fractures, if you can survive that, then there's a liberation that comes to you. And as I said on various occasions, had I not gone through that almost 10-year period fighting the education department and the bureaucracy, I could not have taken the stress that waited for me when I entered the revisionist scene. This is the beauty that when I was... being gunned for by the education department, the bureaucrats, they simply said, one notice I remember reading was when I, through Freedom of Information, I got all my documents there, and it said, why won't he lie down? And this idea that I, as a teacher, they offered me a transfer, but they wouldn't do it in writing. Then they did all sorts of things trying to get me out of the community where I essentially grew up. And I had the parents, I had the most students, only three people who were involved in this whole thing. And this is the amazing thing with the revisionist scene as well. There are not that many who are actually causing this kind of grief that we're fighting. But they have the power. They have that element that really tests our metal, so to speak. And we've got to then not bend. So I'm just jumping now, thinking, well, as soon as I got out of the teaching, And the family broke up, everything broke up. I was essentially free to give my all to this revisionist movement. And we started in 94.
Before we get to
Peter Hartungau does Adelaide Institute. I dropped out in 2009 when I went in for 3 months. By the way, Mr. Hunt, you realize, of course, that there are two types of men, those who've been inside and those who've got it coming to them.
Yeah, I hear you on that one. So before we get to the Adelaide Institute and your work with that starting from 1994, could you just mention to the listeners how you were essentially the highest qualified bus driver in all of Australia, and perhaps, who knows, it could have been the world. I'd like to actually see some data on that. How did you get this title? What made you decide to drive a school bus? And from what I understand, you actually enjoyed that.
Yeah, well, when I was in 67, I left Australia for New Zealand, and I studied at the Victoria University of Wellington. Got my BA there. And then at the end of that, I thought, what should I do now? The Wellington City Council looked for bus drivers. They would train you for 6 weeks and you had to sign up for a year as a bus driver. So I was trained on an old rickety bus, then a trolley bus, and the ordinary conventional diesel bus. And after I finished the training, then I think it was for 2 or 3 weeks, in end of January, I got a position as a teacher, because I'd also applied for teaching, because by then I had my BA degree. And at that time, you could still get a teaching job without having a teaching certificate. So I dropped out of bus driving, but then I had to confront the manager, and I was called into the office, because if you break that contract, if you are trained and then you break the contract, you have to pay, I think it was £60 at the time, a lot of money. And so I walked into the office with the money in my pocket, and I explained to the fellow what was going on. I said, look, I was going to continue driving the bus, but I did get that position as teacher at Lumsden in the South Island, and why not? I said, but I've got the money here. And I handed it over to him, and he looked at me and said, that's what I wanted to see, and now I'd like to say, put it back in your pocket. Thank you very much. I'm pleased to have met you. Now, that gave me a boost that there are individuals who understand, who have certain basic moral values of decency and so on. He realized my situation. He could understand. And that forever stood me in good stead, because then when I went overseas, I would drive a truck or a bus or whatever. And then in 85, when I was dismissed from teaching, my wife was then at the time a nurse at the health center. And of course, I was without a job. I didn't want to go on unemployment. And so the bus operator, he had a fellow who was not too happy, with whom he wasn't too happy. And so he gave me the job. So I had this run from Goroke to Edenhope, my old school, Edenhope, where I then drove that bus for 4 years. At the same time, I did other things, community work, Tidy Town, and so on. In other words, my activity with the community, which was supposed to have been so against me during the teaching, it was just a lie. And so I had the bus, and then slowly, I had politicians and journalists focusing on my situation. They said, there's something not quite right, because I was the first teacher to be dismissed under the teacher union agreement. The unions were on side with the education bureaucracy, and I was a test case. I was given a support group, an inquiry, and then the dismissal. And I must say this, luckily, the dismissal hearing, the final hearing before the Director General, I recorded that. And when I was in 85, when I got legal aid to look at my case, and three law firms looked at the case, said, "No, you've got no case." And then I remember that I had the tape, and I gave that to another lawyer, and he said, "I think your case has stumps, not legs. It's not going to run yet, but we'll have to transcribe this interview." And there it was, a basic principle of British common law, natural justice. Somebody talks about you, and then you should be given a right of reply. Now, this is a fundamental thing that I've done instinctively, and my innate sense of justice simply says, look, if you're talking about someone, give that fellow a reply. Now, what's happening today is that this natural justice principle, legal principle, is thrown overboard. And that is the problem that the discrimination industry shies away from focusing on. When later on in the, when in 94 of 95, the push against me by the Jews in Sydney, but originally from the Simon Wiesenthal Center, when they found that Adelaide Institute was a terrible website, they do not, under the Racial Discrimination Act, you can get a right of reply, but that only serves them as a source of information with which they can then dialectically or in a sophist's way talk their way out of it, because the benchmark is not truth. It's not whether you're telling the truth or telling lies or whether it's a factual thing that you're mentioning or pointing to, but whether you are, by what you're saying, whether that is hurtful to a person. And this is what is now uppermost, and today we call it political correctness. The idea that you must not say certain things because it could be offensive. In 95, I'm still a member of the Australian College of Educators, and you know that gives me the right to put MACE behind my name, letters behind my name. I always laugh about that. But in 95, I gave a talk about political correctness in our schools, and the founder of the Australian College of Educators, Sir James Darling, he responded to me by saying, look, it really, PC is just another word for a return to basic manners. Now, I agree with that PC, political correctness, means that you shouldn't really be offending people, shouting out and doing things like that generally. But the problem is, if somebody is hurt, has his hurt feelings, then there is defamation law. Defamation law, there is the concept of truth that liberates, or that is the test. If you're telling the truth about a person who feels aggrieved by what you've said about them, for example, I was called an anti-Semite and a Holocaust denier. I had this tested in the Supreme Court. No go. We appealed. No go. Then on the 30th of March in the High Court in Canberra, the highest court in Australia, no go. They would not give me the right to have this tested because that would really open a can of worms. So as a revisionist or as somebody who was labeled like that, I cannot defend myself because their justification was, I am not really hurt by these defamatory imputations of being called a Holocaust denier and an anti-Semite, but I am only doing that because I want an audience. I want to talk about matters Holocaust, when in fact this discussion about the Holocaust is all over the internet. I wouldn't need to. My views are known. Yet they would not give me that protection of defamation. They wouldn't give me that legal protection. So what can you do but battle on, Mr. Hunt, battle on?
Who would you say could be viewed as inspirations in your struggle? Were there any people in particular who helped with the formation of the Adelaide Institute, or who inspired you with their own work, perhaps Ernst Zundel? Who were you in contact with or aware of at that point?
Well, when I was in Germany, for 6 years, from 1971 on to 70, February 77, when I got my PhD from Stuttgart University. In 1971, I walked along the Königsplatz in Stuttgart, and I saw this tent and three or four fellows, students, protesting against Rudolf Hess's incarceration. Now, I didn't know until 97, when I met Ernst Zundel in Toronto, that he was the one behind it. I didn't know anything. When I was in Rhodesia, 77 to 79, end of 79, beginning 80, I saw the transition from white to black government. In 79, they talked about the gassings. For example, there was a joke about this tank being pushed along in the Negev Desert or somewhere. And they said, and a dozen people pushing it, dozen men pushing it through the desert. And one by one, in the midday sun, these fellows drop dead and the tank comes to a stop. The hatch opens and a typical German in steel-rimmed glasses looks about and then shouts to below, "Hans, I think we have run out of juice." Now, that's supposed to be a funny one. But time when I, in 95, when I had my problems with the education department, there were other people I knew who were well into the IHR, they were well connected with these, but as a teacher, I did not touch this topic. I mean, that was, you know, it was too disturbing. I focused on the fundamentals of teaching English, of précis writing, of essay writing, of basic work. You should see my wife always complained that I had brought home too much work, because in basic English, you have to correct sentence by sentence. You have to really give them that immediate feedback. And that's very difficult. It's hard work. And I can understand why others then despair if this is not encouraged by the bureaucracy itself. So I then made contact with John Bennett. John Bennett was in legal aid, and he was there, and he said something to the effect, I've written this elsewhere, it's on the record, where he said, well, he's going to assist in getting this case into the courts, but he wants me to be the Zundel of Australia. And I suppose in that respect, I did him proud. Then there was Jeff Muirden. Once I was thrown out of teaching, I came in contact with a lot of individuals, many individuals, Mohammed Ighazi, one example, Sophie Johnson, all those teachers in the education department who'd been thrown out And at that time, the Education Department still had a library that was disbanded. I think it was during, was it Boston saw one fellow's reign? No, Peter Hill. He dismembered the Education Department library. Nobody knows where the books went to. But Jeff Muirden was in there. He wrote reviews of books. He published them in the Herald Sun. Sophie Johnson was there. Muhammad Ighazi was there. All those teachers who'd been naughty to students, for example, kicking a student who misbehaved or kicked a teacher, they kicked back. They were then taken out of class and put into the education library or the correspondence school as well. So that was Jeff Muirden, and then Christopher Steele in Adelaide. He was a great one. He enabled me to begin with David Brockschmidt to start this Adelaide Institute. We had problems in getting the name because there was the Adelaide Institute of TAFE, and in huge letters on a building in town in the center of Adelaide, there was that Adelaide Institute, and we thought, gee, we're going to be in trouble. Then there's another building near the library, which is called the Institute. So when in 99 I was arrested in Germany, the Adelaide City Council tried to get that Adelaide out of our institute because they said I was disgracing the name of Adelaide because I was now in prison and so on. Luckily, 4 months later, there was the Snowtown murder cases. There were individuals who were picking up people on welfare, and they then killed them and put them in oil drums or something like that, and that made world headlines. And then, as well, there was another fellow, a Jew fellow, who embezzled his clients by having got involved with the Nigerian email scam. I think $2-3 million he sent across. He wanted to make more money. He fell for the trick. So in that 94 era, things happened. Not only Tobin was in jail, but other things or other individuals were doing things. So I thought, well, that's not too bad. At least I'm not killing anyone. I'm at least spreading the word of truth about what happened to the Jews during the Second World War. And it certainly wasn't gassing. Well, and I'm very pleased with this, that on the legal record, I stated quite clearly that there were no gassings. The gassing story is an absolute fiction. There's no proof of it. And Professor Deborah Lipset, who claims that there's ample proof, well, only just the other day, I think I got an email where someone stated that she's now whinging about David Irving having robbed her of 6 or 7 years of her life. Well, this is what happens when you tell lies. You are then confronted with individuals who do worry about truth-telling, and that's the important thing, that I remembered when I started my first revisionist trip overseas, meeting Arthur Butts, Forreson, Willis Carto, who else? Germa Rudolph, Jürgen Graf. Meeting all these, I then suddenly realized, hey, the physical work, the physical examinations have been done. What needs to be done is to unlock the legal concrete, smash the legal concrete on these issues. And up to a point, I don't know whether I've been successful, but certainly for me personally, and this has always been at the back of my mind, and this is where I get back to basic philosophical thinking, that, you know, through our self-reflective intelligence, we realize what we actually believe, what we know, and that in well, that then calms you, it liberates you. You know that when somebody comes along like this Professor Deborah Lipset and tells outright lies, fabrications, she may say, oh yes, I made a mistake. Oh no, they're not mistakes. They are intentionally planting outright lies about this gassing story.
Oh yeah.
And that's, we have to continue to fight.
What was the inspiration for you making your first trip to Auschwitz in 1997? And is this when you filmed the scenes of you with the microphone that were used in the 2003 documentary Judea Declares War on Germany, or is that a different occasion?
No, that's the one. That was the big issue in 97, 96 and so on. I got rubbished by a number of individuals here who said, oh, you know what you're talking about, friend. Go on. You don't know anything. You haven't been there, have you? Talking like that. And I said, yeah, this is true. I haven't been to Auschwitz. I don't even know where the place is. Reminds me of when I first went overseas. I was going to go to Rhodesia because Ian Smith had declared UDI. And unfortunately, I was working in the Forest Commission on a holiday job, and I cut my hand with an axe. I couldn't go, so instead I went to New Zealand. But very often, I just didn't know. And this reminds me of Death of a Salesman, where you've got this picture where this uncle says, oh, he didn't know anything about geography, but somehow he landed up in Alaska or somewhere. In other words, being ignorant is, in some respects, a blessing in disguise, because then you have a tabula rasa, an empty slate, a clean slate. You can begin looking for yourself. In all my travels, I did not sit down beforehand to plan what I wanted to see. I went to Russia. I went to Israel, Turkey, all over Europe, Eastern Europe and so on. I did not read books. I wanted to get the feel of a country. So when I came to Auschwitz, I could sense, hey, there's something wrong. You've got this mortuary, you've got the hospital. In 1966, for 6 months, I worked in a mortuary. Not more in a hospital, I was a wardsman. And on the weekends, I had to look after the mortuary, and I saw bodies coming in, and I had to do all sorts of things for the weekend, which sobered me even more so, and it made me almost a non-materialist, because make the sense of running along to make money, tons of money, had no meaning. Once you face death, once you see the bodies, it's so clear that isn't everything. That material world is very often a comfortable world, but it doesn't satisfy the mind. So I arrive at Auschwitz, a fellow, wonderful fellow, who had a camera at that time, still a big camera. He videoed everything. And you know, more you can't do, but look at the evidence and say, that's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. And then, of course, Gemma Rudolph came through, or Fred Leuchter at first. Zundel got Leuchter going. And it's interesting how some individuals try to bucket Fred Leuchter to say, oh, you know, his research wasn't proper. It wasn't good enough. Gemma Rudolph, well, then nobody mentions him. If they come to a testing of whether a certain building was used as a gas chamber. And it's legally locked up. And that, for me, anything that's legally locked up is protected against truth seekers.
And both of those
And
men were heavily penalized, heavily persecuted for
oh
what
yeah,
they
oh
did.
look, and this is why I fully understand people. If they have a family, I could not have done what I've done in the last 25 years had I a family. Couldn't have done it. I've got a twin brother. He's got a family. It's still going strong. I've made a mess of my life. In that respect, I did not succeed. The dearest thing, the ideals that I had, my parents, they were together for 63 years. The ideal is still family, children, offspring, because it goes deeper, deeper, because that is the genetic memory that we tap into. This is so important.
Yes.
Otherwise, what are we there for? Just for our hedonistic, nihilistic sense gratification, as the LGBTIs are doing? That is insane.
Oh.
You're on a roller coaster of sense gratification. That's pathetic.
Welcome back to the Solar Storm. This is Kyle Hunt, and my guest tonight is Dr. Frederick Tobin. You can check out his website, tobin.biz, and see what he's up to over there. I am pleased to say that he is a commenter over at renegadetribune.com. I always thought that was great seeing Frederick Tobin commenting on the articles over there. So it is my pleasure to be speaking with you here tonight. Before the break, we were talking about your visit to Auschwitz, which I'd say is pretty infamous, notorious, and that's to our enemy, perhaps, and legendary to those of us who might have encountered that as one of the first real exposés of the Holocaust. I remember seeing you there looking like an educator, though I didn't know your story, talking about these issues in a very rational way. What great footage you were able to capture there. Could you tell us how you went about doing that? Did you ask for permission? Did you have to be granted any kind of permission to go and do that, or was this pretty much on the spot? You just got your cameras in there, you had your microphone, and you started filming.
I think this is where I was extremely fortunate, because up to that point, 97, it was still possible to simply walk about and not be confronted by anyone. I remember being at Auschwitz-Birkenau, and running over the or walking over the alleged gas chamber roof, and then going in. I had a couple of people watching. If somebody was coming along, they would say, "Oh, look, let's get out of there." But at least we got in. And we had a look, and it's certainly not possible nowadays. I remember 2 years later, they removed a plaque where initially in 97 the position of the so-called gas insertion holes were opposite two, two, and two, and then in 97 that was in line. In a line on the edge of the wall. So these little alterations, adjustments to their story lined up with what Fred Leuchter, even Jürgen Graf and others, and Germa Rudolph especially, said, and Zündel uppermost, that the story keeps on changing. This is one element that of the argument I always remembered. Let's listen to what the enemy has to say, or the so-called other side has to say. The recent example is Deborah Lipstadt's TEDx talk, where she inverts her mindset. And she plays the victim. She essentially equates her quest for truth as being that of what Galileo did. And of course, that is absolute nonsense.
For upholding the orthodoxy. Yes, indeed. That's what she was doing. It is a world that has been absolutely turned upside down on its head. Everything has been inverted. The gas chamber story is just so essential to their narrative. They were willing to come down with the figures in Auschwitz, you know, from 4 million to now it's 1.5. And that was because of the work done by so-called revisionists, people who were saying, no, this official story cannot be correct. So they're willing to drop the numbers, concede, hey, it might not have been 6 million, but some people were gassed. And it looks like they've been able to get a number of high-profile Holocaust questioners on board with this limited gassing nonsense. In particular, there is David Cole, there is Mark Weber, and there is, oh, who am I forgetting here? There's also David Irving. Yes, thank you. And there are actually a few other people now who have jumped on board with this. Eric Hunt has turned around completely and now says, yes, there were gas chambers there. Why is this element so important to them, in your opinion? And why is it also just so ludicrous when you examine the evidence?
I had this experience with my court case in Australia, my defamation action, my failed defamation action against the Australian newspaper, Murdoch, and Senator Christine Milne, who labeled me a Holocaust denier and anti-Semite. Legal papers required that I give my point of view on all sorts of matters. And it was suggested that I should adopt the Irving line, limited gassings. And I said, I can't do that because I cannot see any proof of any gassings. Initially, it was in Auschwitz, Stammlager, Auschwitz I. But in 96, this is since 88, and 88 is the Leuchter report, 93 is Gamma Rudolph's report. And in 96, Robert Jan van Pelt and Deborah Dwork, they wrote their book Auschwitz from 1270 to the present, where they officially decommissioned Crema I as a gas chamber, which to this day is still being sold as one to the tourists. But they stated in their book that Crema I was made to look or to resemble what happened in Crema II, Auschwitz-Birkenau. Now, that was in 96. And I thought, what on earth is going on here? I also visited Michael Shermer. And, he's a skeptic, the Skeptics magazine. The Skeptics have, also in Australia, they're the same thing. I made contact with the Skeptics in Adelaide. And they've got a category, Holocaust denier, where we are bucketed for being deranged, deluded, and everything. And I said to the fellow, look, why? Give me 5 minutes, and you, the other ones, let them debunk me. It never happened. They wouldn't let me do it. Similarly, Michael Shermer, off record, simply said, were he to drop the gas chamber, it would be the end of his existence. I had similar examples. For example, the example of 2008. 2006 in Tehran. We had this Holocaust conference there, and this committee was formed. Christian Lindner, Michel Renouf, Ali Ramin, Dr. Ramin, myself, Bernard Sharp, and Serge Dion. Now, Christian Lindner, after this, jumped off, and he hopped because he was doing other things. He simply then became one of the others, very much like what Eric Hunt did. He now says limited guessings. This is why, on the legal record in Australia, I simply stated, I accept the Holocaust. I do not deny the Holocaust, with a capital H. I do not, what else is there? But the third, the important point was, I do not deny the gas chamber. Sorry, I'm just trying to get it into focus. I do not deny the gassings, the gas chambers. I do not deny the gas chambers. I deny the homicidal gassings. Now, that is the crux.
Right, because there were gas chambers there. They were just used as Indeed. Zyklon B was intended to be used to delouse clothing and other articles.
Yes. I was so happy that this was formulated in such a way that, because had I said, oh, no gas chambers, I'd be done in. So therefore, it's that, I mean, you can say, okay, the Holocaust, I admit that the Holocaust happened, but we would then have to define the term. This would have happened had my defamation action continued. And we would have at last then had a legal definition of what Holocaust and anti-Semite is. You can see at the moment the way the Europeans, the British Labour Party is wrestling at the moment with this problem, because they want any criticism of Israel. There's a faction, Jewish faction, any criticism of Israel is supposed to be anti-Semitic and all that stuff. This is, you know, the blocking, 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 and protecting a lie. A lie which is a profitable enterprise. It's a myth that gassings occurred, homicidal gassings occurred. And once we realize that, well, let them go ahead. Let them sue. Let them do something. But they won't. And you know, in the High Court, I did send you that Ronald Ray article from the Barnes Review. Did you have a chance of reading that?
Yes, I did read that.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, sometimes I'm so amazed that there are others who see things far more clearly than I do. It happens very often that you're in the thick of things. You can't really immediately stand back and observe what you're doing. It's therefore very interesting then to get feedback that in fact illuminates things that you instinctively know about, but it hasn't come into focus. And hence, this is why it's important also, as you know yourself, to be talking about these things, to be reflecting on your own person. If you are worrying about the next generation, then you must confront these horrible things that cost you energy and stress and all sorts of things.
Yes. Before we talk more about your most recent legal struggle, very, very interesting, as you were trying to sue people for defamation, for falsely labeling you. Back in 1998, you were imprisoned for defaming the dead. This is one of the most absurd charges that I could ever imagine. Defaming the dead. This is what got you thrown in prison. Could you explain a little bit more about what the definition of defaming the dead is and how you fell into that and how you spent 9 months at Mannheim prison in Germany?
Yes, that was in 99. It was in 99.
Oh, excuse me.
In 97, I had this world trip meeting all the revisionists. And I must say, again, so that people are aware of this. I was looking for the center. Where is this revisionist center? It must be somewhere. All I met was individuals and organizations that were independently focusing on the same topic and coming to similar conclusions. There was no real revisionist center as such. And in 1998, I visited the public prosecutor in Mannheim, Klein, Heiko Klein, and I said, you know, what's the legal basis on which you basing all this stuff? And he said, well, you know, it's defaming the memory of the dead and so on. I said, but how can you? If you ask questions, you must ask questions. So in 99, on my second round the world trip, I also visited Klein again. And I said, look, they've changed the plaque. At Krematu, Auschwitz, Birkenau, where the holes, they used to be like this at one time, now they're just in one line. And then he got up and said, no, I'm arresting you. So I was arrested in his office. And, you know, the stupid thing, I was allowed to make phone calls, and I made one phone call, one phone call to my brother, and he said, well, that's what you wanted, wasn't it? And I said, no, it wasn't. I didn't prepare myself too well for that arrest.
You didn't think that stating facts would get you arrested for defaming the memory
exactly,
of the dead?
Exactly. But now comes the German law. It's, in fact, very much like what's going through the world now, even in America, where they're trying to disconnect from the First Amendment through this hate speech. It's a watered-down version of defamation law, where the defense of truth, which is absolute, it doesn't exist anymore. It's merely hurt feelings. And you can get anybody to come along, to pick anybody off the street and say, now I'm blah, blah, blah. Now, have you got hurt feelings? And if you put money in his pocket, he'll say, oh, lots of hurt feelings, and so on. And this is how it works. It's total corruption of the legal system. This is what we're fighting, the corruption of the legal system, where defaming the memory of the dead only applies to the Jew, to the Jewish memory, but not the Germans. In fact, you know, this is what I was pleased when the AfD in Germany, one fellow said, what a shame it is to see the Holocaust memorial in the center of Berlin under, I think it's under Hitler's bunker. It's on top of Hitler's bunker. Hitler's bunker's beneath it. He said that it's a shame. It's the only nation in the world that celebrates its guilt and so on. And this is what the Germans have to do. And Zündel fought so hard to bring this about, that get off your knees, do something, and stop accepting the guilt trip that's being enforced legally.
Well, you know what's a good example of synchronicity here is that the AfD actually just entered parliament. They won, I think, 14% of the popular vote. So this is causing quite a crisis right now for certain people in Germany, and the Jews of Germany are very concerned that the AfD, who doesn't want to dishonor the German dead, that they are now a force within the political spectrum. And it's going to be interesting to see what unfolds here. There have been different risings within Germany. You see certain things, although it might be controlled opposition, with the big marches in Dresden with Pegida, and there's a lot that could be said about that. But the spirit of the German people is awakening, and it is great to see, and there are a lot of supporters around the world. I'd like to go back and talk about what happened. It seems starting sometime perhaps around 2000 with your ordeal with the Australian Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission, and how that seems to have led to the Federal Court of Australia then getting you for anti-racial hatred in laws against speech on your website. So please, can you tell us about how your website had caught the attention of this group and what they tried to do?
Yes, it started in 95 when the Simon Wiesenthal Center, Los Angeles, sent a message via, I think it was the Brisbane Courier Mail, a small article about a hate site being discovered at Adelaide Institute. That was in 95. That was then picked up by a local Jew, Jeremy Jones. He was at that time known as the Foreign Minister of the Jews in Australia. He was a journalist and he put a complaint into the newly constituted human rights, or it was actually Equal Opportunity, Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission. Later on, that became the Human Rights Commission. But the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission, which specifically formulated this idea that the hurt feeling was important. In other words, the watered down version of a defamation legal construct. And we came along in 96. We had the first hearing. And I asked the commissioner, who at that time was a lecturer, law lecturer at Adelaide University, I asked her whether truth was a defense. And she talked blah, blah, blah. And I said, please, commissioner, don't pussyfoot about. Tell me, is truth a defense in these proceedings? And she still wouldn't. And then I continued and said, if truth is not a defense, then lies flourish and this becomes an immoral situation and I will not participate in it. And so we walked out. That was in 96. Then, interestingly, I'm jumping ahead to 99 while I was in prison at Mannheim. This commissioner, Kathleen McAvoy, she went to Mannheim and received a human rights award from the University of Mannheim. So I thought, how interesting. While I was in there in prison, she receives an award. She had not at that time handed down her report, but a year later, in 2000, in October, I think it was sometime at the end of 2000, she handed down the report and found me guilty of hurting people feelings, or
Hate speech.
hate speech. But it wasn't as sort of that hate speech hadn't come through yet. Alan Dershowitz had not as yet split free expression into free speech and hate speech. He only did that later on. But it was in that era, in the late 90s, beginning 2000, this is where this hate speech came through. Free expression was split. And I always try to bring back, let's not talk about free speech, let's talk about free expression. But that would defeat splitting free speech, hate speech.
So
Anyway,
did this
yeah.
ruling have any teeth to it, the human rights?
No, this is the point. It had no enforcing power. So the matter was then transferred to the federal court, and which then had enforcing powers, and that occurred in 2008 in the form of, 2009, when I was then found guilty of contempt of court. I was ordered not, oh, in fact, I initially in 2007, after I came back from Iran, through the Holocaust Conference. And that's interesting. I must mention that it's interesting that after the conference in December 2006, I was lucky even to get there because the Germans, Horst Mahler, Günter Deckert, and who else was there? They had their passports taken from them by the German authorities so that they could not travel to Iran to end the, to attend the conference. I mean, this is how bad they went. And I left for Tehran a couple of weeks earlier because I had the arrangement that we would be looking at the list of the people who would be coming and so on. And while I was in Iran, David Brocksmith informed me that there was not an arrest warrant, but I had to have a court appearance on the, I think it was on the 5th or something like that of December. Now, had I stayed a week longer at home, I would have been, my passport would also have been taken from me. So luckily I escaped and I made it to the conference.
Well, can we talk about
now,
can we talk about the conference for just a moment? What was your experience there? I've seen a picture of you with the former president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and it seemed like a pretty legendary conference that was held. What was your takeaway from that?
I think it was one of the high points of the revisionist movement that a government actually dared not deny or whatever, but to review, not even to question the Holocaust, but to review. This subtle difference, this is how sophisticated the Iranians are in their thinking. The obvious anti-Holocaust people, those who believe in this story, they could not see the difference. They say they simply labeled him as, oh, he's a Holocaust denier. No. It's far more subtle than that. He simply wanted people to come and talk about it. We had the Torah True Jews, or the Naturai Karta, who hate Israel, but they still believe in the Holocaust. but they're outsiders of the Jewish movement, so to speak, and therefore they were welcomed there, and the spread of individuals, left wing, right wing, whatever, all that kind of input was there, and at the end a committee was formed, unfortunately, that committee hasn't done much work because once Dr. Ahmadinejad lost his presidency to Rouhani, it changed the perspective politically. For example, I noticed how divided the institute was that hosted the Foreign Institute that hosted this conference. Among the people, it was a great battle within Iran. It divided the Iranian establishment that they held this conference, and to this day, of course, it lingers there. But those attending, it's in some respects a confirmation that the power of the Jewish lobby is extensive and it has a global reach. So the Holocaust title was Holocaust, A Global Perspective, which in some respects not, well, it challenged those who had an unreserved belief and a dogmatic tenacity in holding to the official version. I think we broke that. And even, you know, now and again, whenever Iran comes into the news, then that'll be pulled out. they had this conference. Various other conferences in where else? In Lebanon, that was cancelled. We had the, well, the sting of Holocaust, what would you say, of Holocaust study reached its point here. And I think I sent you that, the George Michael article that still tried to savage the conference from the perspective of the Orthodox version of the narrative that most people still believe in.
Now, do you think at this point the case has been made, the facts are on the table, and there really isn't a whole lot more work to be done? Or do you think that there still needs to be extensive studies conducted, research, there are new angles that need to be uncovered? Or is it just a matter of now, as you said before, breaking through the legal cement, or and I also would say breaking through the mental barriers of the people who believe in the story, which will aid in the process of finally getting a real review of what happened?
What I notice at the moment is that those who have been running with the Holocaust know the game is up, and so they're switching over to anti-Semitism again. And they're positioning Holocaust denial into that fabric of anti-Semitism. In the past, Holocaust denial could stand on its own and you'd be knocked out. That cannot happen anymore. And therefore, when you see the movements, even in America, where there are massive efforts to cement anti-Semitism into the social fabric, into the legal fabric, Holocaust denial be riding on top of that. And it just reminds me, we're in a situation that Russia found itself in. And when the Soviet Union was founded, the first thing they criminalized was anti-Semitism. That was the first concept. The second one was revisionism. You were not allowed to revise. For the first one, you were shot outright. For the second one, you were sent to the gulags. Now, this is what the Jews did in Russia. The same mindset is doing this now on a global scale. We find this with the internet, how, for example, American Free Press or the Barnes Review, how they are being hamstrung financially, and how others have their services disconnected. I'm still amazed that you're still going.
Sometimes I am as well. As far as the AFP and Barnes Review go, they had their credit card processing taken away. They were taken off of Amazon, quite a few of their books. I'm not sure if it was all of them. And similar things have been happening across the board. I've been taken off of a number of different things, such as Patreon to raise funds, and they have definitely come down hard on anybody who's been effective. They censored Hellstorm on YouTube, and even still it was able to get a few million views. So they know that the other side of the story cannot be stopped right now. So it seems that they're pulling out all of the stops and attempting to somehow contain it in some way, and just make the information inaccessible to inquiring minds so that only the official Orthodox version is heard. And they could simply even do this by controlling the search results on Google, let's say. They've been doing this very effectively, where once upon a time, if you asked who controls Hollywood, you'd be able to get a straightforward answer of who actually controls Hollywood. But now you'd have to go to something like page 15 in order to get a truthful website who's going to expose what's going on. They are manipulating information in a very devious way. They do this with Wikipedia, as you have known in your efforts to try to revise the information about yourself, which you know is incorrect on their page, but they don't really seem to care about that. It needs to fit in line with their agenda, and outright falsehoods are allowed to just slide when when they're the ones who are in control of the information. Let's get back to the narrative of what happened after you came back from the conference in Iran. Do you think that what happened to you in, what was it, 2009 with the contempt of court was a direct response from your going to Iran and taking part in that conference, or was it just a number of different factors that you had ruffled too many feathers?
It's a process. I came back then at the end of 2007. I was invited to apologize for having certain material on the website, and I was to remove certain items. Now, I did that. I signed the apology in November 2007, I think, and David Brockschmidt and others, they felt sick. I felt sicker after I apologized because I had a court-appointed lawyer ring me the night before to say, oh, look, this is the text. Will you sign it tomorrow morning? So overnight, I don't think I slept, but the next morning I signed it, read it out to the court, because it also said, and there will be the legal fees will be wiped. In other words, no claim for costs. Now, my lawyer then afterwards, we said, oh, look, this is nonsense. And he just said, oh, well, you lost the war, meaning as a German, as an Australian of German background, I lost the war. So that kind of thing came up again from his side. Then I started deleting. And I remember on the Friday, I got to the point where I was asked to delete a link on the website. And I said to myself, how can I delete that when that is not mentioned in the apology and that is not part of the whole program of deleting allegedly hurtful, offensive material? So I unilaterally revoked my apology and said, no, we're back in business. I withdraw this apology because I see there's deception going on here, outright deception. And so a year later, I was back in court, and this time I had a lawyer. Up to that point, I was doing things myself, and this time I had a lawyer who represented me, and he tried his best, but in April or so, I was found guilty of contempt of court, because a lawyer, a judge had ordered me not to do certain things. I did. Okay, in contempt of court. Luckily, contempt of court is not a criminal matter. And if I have contempt of court, I traveled to America. I had to declare that I was in prison. But the argument is contempt of court is not a criminal matter. It was only for 3 months. So it's on the record, of course, but the argument now comes down to this, that I spent time in prison, even in London, for 2 months, but it was not for actually Holocaust denial. In London, it was going to be, well, it was just a detention. In Australia, it was for contempt of court. In Germany, it was defaming the memory of the dead, not Holocaust denial. So you can see how they wheedle or weasel their way out of these things by not mentioning things as they should have. This was going to be tested in London. That was the interesting thing. In London, on my way. I just left Arthur Butts at Chicago. He took me to the airport, and I flew to London. I was going to go to Dubai, and the plane stopped. An announcement came through: we have an incident. And then I saw a fellow with a bib running through, right up to where I sat on the plane at the back. I was in the second last seat, in a two-row seater, and I had moved to the middle seat. It was empty, and that's where I slept all night. And so when this fellow walked up to that one, there was somebody else that sat in my seat, and he just shook his head, and I thought, I think they're looking for me. And then the fellow walked out again, then the announcement, would Dr. Tobin please stand up and identify himself? So I stood up, and they said, would you please come to the front door exit? And you know, that was the longest walk I've ever had to do. I only had my small bag. I've learned to travel light. You don't have suitcases anymore, just your bag, your computer bag, if possible. That's all. And I walked along from the back of the plane to the front, and I saw two policemen outside, standing outside. And I walked up, and I stopped about 7 feet from the door, and I said, I think I'll have to make a record of this. I put my hand in my pocket to take out my camera, and I got jumped. I praise the police the way they grabbed me. I was disarmed immediately. And they did it so professionally. It was marvelous, but it hurt. It hurt. And then, anyway, I was carted off. And when you're carted off, you're taken to court immediately. And you know that you only have one go at saying your bit. And I did that. Because once you're in there, then you have a court-appointed lawyer, and you say no more. They speak on your behalf. So when I was in court, the judge said, oh, well, we have this European arrest warrant for all sorts of, well, blah, 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 whatever it was written on there. And I said, this does not apply. The European arrest warrant, the Schengen Agreement excludes this. And I also said that when the European arrest warrant was formulated, the British legal system excluded matters Holocaust. And so I said, I will not get a fair trial. It's a witch trial mentality that pervades in Germany. You have legal representation. From my own experience, I could say I had a legal person, a lawyer representing me. He didn't say anything because 4 months before he had been convicted and fined 10,000 Mark, Deutschmark at the time, for defending Gunter Deckert too vigorously. Can you imagine? A lawyer defending a client too vigorously.
That's what happened to Sylvia Stoltz, isn't it?
Indeed. It was just to repeat what Bock, what he did, defended Deckard too vigorously. Sylvia Stoltz, the same thing, except she topped it by, as she was carried out, saying, Sieg Heil. That was sort of a funny thing at the same time. And long live the German Reich, or something, she said something like that. But so I was behind this glass frame thing. The court was full of lovely supporters, Michel Renouf among them, who later on organized the defense. But interestingly, I had a legal person come to me afterwards, an Indian lady working for a firm, and I engaged her. Then in the morning or the next day, another fellow came, and he actually took my case, because the key word, Lady Michelle Renouf has organized me. I said, okay, marvelous, I'll take you. What happened then, the defense for that other firm with that Indian lady who did the thing. She gave me the legal papers, and I handed them to Mr. Watson. He was the barrister who handled my case. I'm just trying to think. You see, this is when there's so many names you have to remember. It's so difficult.
So what was happening here, just to reiterate for the listeners, the German authorities wanted to extradite you from the UK because of the material on your website. On Wikipedia, it says that they had three boxes ticked for your crimes for which you should be extradited: racism, xenophobia, and cybercrime.
Yes, indeed. Now, this is the beauty, that the fact that they ticked the racism box, they can't get me on racism because I've been all over the world and I have no problem with other races. My time in Nigeria was productive. I learned something marvelous. In Nigeria, we had at the university there, or the College of Advanced Education in Minna, we had white Europeans who felt superior to the Nigerians because of the corruption. And so what I said to my students, I got along well with them, and I said, look, you know, some of your guest lecturers, they think that Nigeria is just full of it's corruption, it's a terrible place. And one student put his hand up, and I said, yes. And he said, it is true. In Nigeria, we have bribery and tribery and corruption at the top. But you in the West are also corrupt, except you in the West are at an advanced stage of corruption.
Yeah, that is very now, true.
How do you like that? That's an insight. I've had that with me for a long time. Then there were others. English lecturers. I mean, one fellow, he finished a bottle of whiskey very quickly. But his poetry and what he did, it was marvelous. I would, you know, if he would get along anywhere in the world. But the political system is so tribalistic. And the problem is that this is, at the moment in Nigeria, it's being exploited also by Jews, who thrive on, well, you have the Biafran conflict, how that degenerated. There are 25 or whatever federal states. They should be all separate countries. None of this business of having a united Africa. It's nonsense. Well, but anyway, get back to the question.
When they force people together, it's going to cause conflict. This is inevitable. It has been seen all
Indeed.
Over. And so they're essentially breeding racism by forcing disparate groups together when they shouldn't actually be living together. And the problem with some of these charges, such as racism, is that they don't properly define their terms. And
yeah.
It, of course, none of this is ever applied to Israel, racism and xenophobia, when it's exemplified.
Absolutely,
there.
Absolutely. And this is the problem. When the judge looked at the European arrest warrant, she said it was deficient. Now, when I was overnight, I was let out and I spent a week at Michel Renouf's home. And she organized a conference. Forreston came and she wanted me to go there as well to attend this conference to celebrate our victory. I contacted immigration. I contacted the police. I said, listen, what do you want me to do? And they said, we would like you to, because I was going to be on sort of probation. I was being watched. And I then asked, what do you want me to do? They said, please, if you can, leave as quietly as possible. That would be our wish. And I did that. Now, some would say, oh, I did a runner. When the Herald Sun in Victoria, in Australia, reported my return, they said, oh, he ran off. He ran away. Well, you know, that's smearing. I can live with that. But the important thing was, my intention was not to go to London. It was a transit. They interrupted that. Then they gave me the opportunity for 2 months to I lived with a Nigerian in the prison cell. It was marvelous. We got along well, and I'm quite sure that was done on purpose, because they thought that I would have had problems sharing a cell with a Nigerian. But then, so I then left and went via America back to Australia. I was going to go to South Africa, but I let that go because by this time it was not safe. I had word from South Africa that there were things going on as well, because this Muslim radio station, 756, or forget the number, but in Cape Town, they were being accused of anti-Semitism and racism and so on. So I could have, you see, the Jews at the time, they were still mulling over what they could do to the whites in South Africa, but most of the Jews had come by this time to Australia or elsewhere. They had left. Once their program collapses, they disappear, as they are now also vacating Israel itself, going back to Berlin and escaping to Ukraine and so on.
Well, I've been hearing that a lot of them are actually fleeing Western Europe and making aliyah to Israel. I have no idea what to believe about the ins and outs
of
Israel.
I don't believe this. I spent time on an Israeli kibbutz, Kiryat Shmona, in 1971. And I then heard from a Russian fellow, Shmuel. He said that the kibbutz system is breaking down or has broken down. In other words, Israel has massive problems. Avram Burg, the former Speaker of the House, all these people, they have got a problem because they know that Martin Heidegger was right when he said the Jews, with their marked gift for calculating, live already for the longest time, according to the principle of race, which is why they are resisting its consistent application with utmost violence. Can you improve on that?
I personally cannot. Can we talk a little bit more about your most recent legal case, which it seems ended in you having to pay $1 million for court costs and legal fees? Obviously, it would seem you cannot pay this. What happened with the defamation case, and what are you to do about this?
Yeah, very basically, it was rejected, and both sides, it's about $500,000 court costs. This is how much it costs, and this is the point. I was bankrupt when I started this action. When you're a bankrupt, you can't do any legal action unless because your physical life is controlled by the trustee. But you can and still have control over your own life, your reputation. And therefore, I found a lawyer who was able to do this, and he initiated this. Reluctantly, it was accepted. It was a big battle, even getting it into court. And then, of course, the first stage, they said, it's an abuse of process because all I want to do is talk about Holocaust. And the appeal, the appeal supported that decision, that it was an abuse of process. And then the High Court did the same. And within a minute, they just said, no problems with the decision below, with the Supreme Court and Supreme Court appeal decisions. So they supported that, and therefore that was the end. So court costs, and it's just on 500, I owe 500,000 to my side and 500 to the other side. So I'm in bankruptcy mode at this very moment. So please, if you think of doing anything like that, make sure you have no property. I've said this before, make sure that you hurt not your loved ones, that you can do this, because there are two ways of, eliminating opposition. And one is by physically killing a person, or the other way by taking the livelihood. And well, that's what it's all about then. The big battle, and I've lost it.
Now, with your conclusion here that you've lost it, I don't think that you might have lost a battle or some battles, but I'd say that the war is not yet determined, and I think you've played a big, big part in what I foresee as our coming victory here. So I thank you for everything you've done. But looking back at your life, and I know hindsight is 20/20, if you could go back and change things, would you do so to really change the way you approach this these problems?
All over again.
You do it all over again.
Mr. Hunt, I would do it all over again in the same way, no different, because I've proven that the Talmudic Tanakh principles of killing the opposition is there. Jeremy Jones in a program said he would stop me from functioning. And he's done that up to a point, because there are always other individuals who see the injustice of it. And that is part of our Western tradition. That is part of our humanity. I would even go so far as to say our Germanic thinking, or whatever European cultural leavening. And this is where I then find comfort in Wagner. I listen to the Wagnerian music. In the depth lie tenderness and truth in the water, and false and faint-hearted above. In other words, it's nothing new. Nothing new is under the sun. If, as long as we don't take it personally, we ride the storm brilliantly. You know, and then everything collapses, but then the Rhine cleanses us again. Fantastic. And we begin again.
Well, you know what? We spent all of this time going over your biography and going over some details about Holocaust, so-called revisionism, but we really didn't get to hear enough about the way that you see the world, some of your philosophical, literary inspiration. So hopefully we'll be able to have another conversation in the future and get to some of your thoughts about other subjects, because I think that the audience would really benefit greatly from that. We have run out of time here. I encourage everyone to go over to Tobin.biz. Thank you so much for spending your time here with me tonight. That it really has flown.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thanks to all the supporters. We'll be back.
Marvelous. Soon.